listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The Glow in the Corner. The director of Small Axe and 12 Years a Slave, on his childhood inspiration, by Steve McQueen. In the photos, John Boyega in the Small Axe episode Red, White, and Blue. Steve McQueen directing Shea Cole in the episode Alex Sweetle. The TV was always on in my house. It was like the fireplace. Somehow, the glow from the corner of the room would always give comfort, even if what was projected out of it was not entirely good news. Frequently, the question would be, "Why is the television not on?" Or, accusingly, "Put on the TV." I suppose, in one aspect, it was meditative and beneficially numbing after the outside racist world my family and I contended with. Tony Curtis was someone I met on television as a trapeze artist, as Harry Houdini, as a musician, and as a heartthrob. I'm not sure why I was drawn to him, but for some reason, through all the gray surroundings of my London existence, I took to him, and every time there was a Tony Curtis film on TV, I'd be excited. My first memory of him was him attempting to do the dangerous triple somersault aided by Burt Lancaster in Trapeze, 1956, and there being a weird love triangle between the two men and Gina Lollobrigida. Then, The Vikings, 1958, again playing the young upstart, with Kirk Douglas taking him under his wing this time. I enjoyed Tony, as a lot of people did. Elvis, too. He modeled his hair on him and dyed it to match. My first day on a film set was in rainy, gray Belfast. My first scene, a man being assassinated at an old people's home as he visits his mother. The scene was from Hunger, 2008, my first feature film starring Michael Fassbender. In Hunger, there is a 17-and-a-half-minute conversation between Bobby Sands and a priest, Father Dom. After a few attempts, I felt something was happening in the room. I can't describe it. The only word I can think of is God. I remember clearly saying it to Michael and Liam Cunningham, who plays the priest. I sent the whole crew away, and then I told them, "You have to bring God here." I don't know why I said that. Possibly I needed guidance of my own. Possibly to cut through the bullshit, to pierce their armor. I had to say something I knew would penetrate, no matter how abstract it was. I knew they would hear me, and they did. I shot the whole conversation in one unbroken take. Actors, for me, are musicians. You write the music with the harmony and the melody, and within that they perform. And I'm interested in hearing things that I have never heard before. Recognizable but unfamiliar, or familiar but unrecognizable. Something that will surprise because it is so truthful. Working with John Boyega on the Small Axe episode, Red, White, and Blue, was a strange affair. Art, in effect, was imitating life. During production, John was very prominent in the Black Lives Matter march in London, demonstrating against the death of George Floyd. His speech was heard around the world. Emotions poured out of him unfiltered. In the audience of thousands, unbeknownst to John, was the man he was portraying in Red, White, and Blue, Leroy Logan. Around that time, John spoke of his unfortunate relationship with Star Wars. This paralleled Leroy's relationship with London's Metropolitan Police. Through no fault of their own, these two talented men were let down by these institutions. They were literally deemed poster boys, only to be failed. These events led John to fulfill a want and a need in his artistry as an actor, to commit and to risk, to dare. The light from the corner was always generous. Without it, I can honestly say I would not be working in film and TV. But it was not lost on me that I didn't see people who represented my existence on television, and I imagine in a way I always wanted in. In a way, Small Acts was all about seeing myself lying on the floor with my hands propping up my head as the glow from the TV covered me, and wanting to see history and stories that had not been told.
Thank you.
will woke go up in smoke? What I do know is Virtue Usually Flowers When You're Vulnerable by Jenny Lamette. With illustration by Nyung Lee of a white woman with long hair wearing a mask and looking as if she's peering through a porthole. In the Whole Foods on Montana Avenue, at the top of the lockdown and right after George Floyd's murder, a Santa Monica lady and I reached for the same avocado at the same time. When I say Santa Monica lady, I mean a white lady. Her child was beautiful, like all the children in the Whole Foods. They were masked. Masked, beautiful, healthy, reverse bandits, as there was nothing they would ever steal. They only wanted to give back. I know this because I read their T-shirts. These were people to whom things mattered. I was also masked, a masked black person. Side note, my mother, 84, lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and goes daily to Marsh Madison, which is her nearest grocery store. There are very few essentials at this store, mostly things you'd choose to eat as opposed to things you'd need to eat. My mother refers to herself as the masked Negro of Marsh Madison. Mother is a savage. During the avocado skirmish, I registered Santa Monica lady's confusion at my pale pigmentation. She was not the first, nor will she be the last. The spectrum of American blackness is vast and beautiful. I have a white father and am also the direct descendant of enslaved Africans. My children's DNA is in the floorboards of the Calhoun Mansion in South Carolina. John C. Calhoun himself is my great times five grand rapist. Proximity to whiteness comes with privileges, far too many to list here. In the movie business, as in every other business, I suspect, you certainly get hired faster and more often, and you get called the N-word by the recipient of a Golden Globe, and then again by an EGOT, hashtag moving on up. The SML's confusion, was I white? And if I was white, did that mean it was okay if she just claimed the avocado, only lasted a beat before she erred on the side of wokeness? I'm sorry, she said. I'm so, so sorry. I know why she was sorry. She feared that I, a masked black stranger, would perceive her as a bad person. And when I say bad person, I mean a racist, a person who felt entitled to take the avocado, as she had been taking avocados all her life. First, ahead of. The fact that she feared I might think this of her confirms that she may well have been a racist and had apologized only because she had watched George Floyd's murder on her TV. How do I know what was triple sao-chowing through her brain? I know because I know. Experience is expertise. You can't buy or relocate out of this bullshit. You can't just say I'm sticking to the coast. I also know because the sao-chow has permutations, and I've done a version of it myself. One time, during a 12-day hospital stay in New York City years ago, while I was sick as a dog, my roommate, a black lady, was garrulous. She had her entire family visiting, and they were garrulous, too. It was the yellingest family in Lenox Hill Hospital. I was trying not to die, so I said nothing but passive-aggressively shot baleful, wounded glances in their direction. The behavior, thought I. My thought bubble has the British spelling. That's how much of an asshole I am. And a member of the lady's family said, that white girl thinks we're too loud. Hilarum, accent, accent. Immediately defensive and panicked, I longed to say, wait, I'm not a white girl and a racist. I'm a black girl who's internalized colorism. When the toxin has lived in you, you can smell it in other people. So I knew about the Santa Monica avocado lady, because I know. And here's my question. Now that it's no longer 2020, will woke go up in smoke? To my understanding, wokeness is a thing that means you take a real look at the world and how you move through it. If one is an asshole, one tries to remedy. I am always working on that one. Always. And it's a process. No one just hears the alarm and leaps out of bed. Mostly, we all hit snooze 70 billion times and then wonder why we're late. There's a long history of public murder and of hitting the snooze button. I did a very non-scientific poll among my friends. All of them are women and very, very tired. Will woke go up in smoke? I asked them. One of my friends is a phone sex worker, and she deals with folk on a pretty primal level. She is always a black woman, but sometimes not, depends who might be calling. I had a guy who had curated his fantasies to make sure I know he's woke, like I care, and he doesn't want to do it anymore, she told me. Since November, he's just been rage venting. He did everything he was supposed to do, but everyone's still mad at him. Wait, everyone's mad at him? Everyone who? I don't know. The black lady in his office, she makes him feel castrated or something. Now he's angry. He's angry at the language. I was like, you know, you're actually in a safe space now, right? And he totally lost his heart on. Boom. He doesn't want to hear about safe spaces or talk about this shit anymore. If I wasn't making this guy be woke. By the way, he's super dom now. Okay, here's what I deduced from all this. One, my friend is doing the Lord's work. Two, woke is sustainable only under a very particular set of circumstances. Three, woke is unsustainable while effing. I'm the fourth generation of my family. Yep, the fourth. To work in show business, and the only thing I know for sure is that virtue usually flowers when you're vulnerable. I created a show about a black family at a big streaming service, not the streamer on which I currently have shows. Said show was based on my fancy family, the head people in charge, all of whom were SMLs, including the guys, said, "We love your fancy family. We love the sophistication, ha ha ha. Please let us know if we say anything racist, dumb, or do anything racist, stupid." They were vulnerable. They were, like the SML, afraid they would be judged and found wanting. That judgment would live in the tiniest corner of their brain and haunt them like the fitted sheet that doesn't match anything anymore, but is somehow always in the effing closet. And then, somehow, they weren't afraid. Maybe it was repeated exposure. They said, "Do you guys really talk like that? And also, can we have a scene where someone is getting thrown over a cop car for relatability? Because we feel the privilege of your family is getting in the way of our commentary on race." My blackness was getting in the way of their commentary on race. These were suddenly some very confident SMLs. At the 11th hour, they ask if we could introduce the lightest skinned character first. Colorism was a theme of the show, so the blackness of her family could be a reveal. Ha ha, funny. I confronted. They said I ask loaded questions and shouldn't. I made a bet with the showrunner that their next show about black people would have slaves in it. I won. For many, the miasma of fear that was 2020 is lifting. There are vaccines. Those people no longer live in the White House. Many, myself included, feel less vulnerable. It's going to get better. And a lot of people will be happy not to talk about this shit anymore. One of my friends insists wokeness is here to stay. There's a whole new level of awareness, she says. The bell has been rung. It's been ringing forever, but whatever. Yet the Zooms of my world still look like my high school yearbook. The Dalton School, New York City, class of 1984. In other words, thumbprints of whiteness punctuated with the rare brown exclamation point. I heard a famous black comedian talk about me, too. This connects. Hang on. He seemed to have complex feelings about it, to which he's entitled. But then he said, ladies, you don't tell on us as much as you could. We know that, but it's going to be worse for you when this moment goes away. I don't think it was a threat, though it felt like one. I think he believed he was warning us of the punishment to come. Me too will go away. The tolerance for listening will max out, and Dad will turn around and say, you've had your fun. I'm pulling this goddamn car over right now. And then beat the kids for having a moment. the Warner Wars. Did one of Hollywood's oldest studios kill moviegoing as we know it, or drag us into the future? By Richard Rushfield. Opening illustration by Jorge Arevalo, in which a man and a woman are dressed in casual clothing and walking on the Warner Brothers lot. It's entirely likely that December 3rd, 2020, will go down as the day moviegoing suffered a fatal ice pick from the cold, calculating hand of the streaming revolution. That was the day Warner Media, the entertainment division of AT&T and corporate inheritor of Warner Brothers, century-old studio home of Kubrick and Eastwood, Bugs Bunny and Harry Potter, Casablanca and Gone with the Wind, announced it would release its entire 2021 slate straight to the American living room via limited runs on its HBO Max service, and in whatever theaters would have them too. From 40,000 feet, it was a sensible, even perfunctory move. Theaters have been largely shut down by COVID for a year and could be on ice for another. Warner Media has a 9-month-old streaming service fighting a near-impossible battle against Netflix and Amazon. The movies sitting on its shelf, which included Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman sequel and Denis Villeneuve's Dune adaptation, could give the floundering app a boost. Hollywood didn't quite see it that way. While Disney and Universal had experimented in the pandemic with straight-to-streaming runs, the scale of the Warner Brothers announcement was an affront. In Hollywood logic, Warners had ignited a bomb under the rickety framework holding the whole town together. With one voice in public statements and private murmurs, the entertainment community rose as rarely before. AT&T has hijacked one of the most respectable and important studios in film history. There is absolutely no love for cinema, nor for the audience here, Villeneuve wrote in Variety. Christopher Nolan, the studio's most consistent rainmaker, twisted the knife. Some of our industry's biggest filmmakers and most important movie stars went to bed the night before thinking they were working for the greatest movie studio and woke up to find out they were working for the worst streaming service. The otherwise discreet and circumspect CAA chief Richard Lovett issued a public letter. Warner Brothers has made a statement that relationships with artists and their representatives are not important to the studio. Warner Media declined to comment for this story. So why the torches in the streets against an otherwise artist-friendly studio? For starters, the money, particularly the idea that artists might lose a bunch of it. Most of the major players involved in a film work for a percentage of the film's gross. That is, its gross at the box office. Warner's was potentially robbing the participants of an expected payday. Another possible translation for the agent's messaging in all this, now you're going to pay and pay big. Sure enough, reports surfaced in January that the studio would adjust contracts to reflect the new box office reality. Egos factor in as well, of course. Many of these directors made their movies with the notion that one day audiences would enjoy them in theaters. But the response was also a primal scream pent up for years. Just how the erstwhile Ma Bell found itself to be the enemy of entertainment is a perfect case study in the various pressures at play in movie making circa 2021. In one sense, this is all a sideshow to the larger battle being waged by telecom giants to wire the nation with 5G connections. The price tag for that build-out has been estimated at more than $1 trillion. Beside which, a film studio, which in a good year might bring in $4 billion, is a pinprick in the bucket. Having built this network, the phone company will want things to run through it, attracting people and their data to the service. But AT&T was no reckless Silicon Valley tech bro. The company had become known for a risk-averse accountants culture. Their efforts were led by John Stankey, a 6'5" actual L.A. native who looks like a linebacker and talks like the footnotes of a business school textbook. First as mastermind of the company's DirecTV acquisition, then as czar of the company's combined entertainment properties, then as chief of the entire company, Stankey pursued a strategy that attempted to recreate the Netflix miracle out of the odds and ends he'd inherited. That miscellany included the most highly regarded brand in television, HBO. But while Succession viewers might be a lot of people, they're not everyone. And by the logic that defined Netflix's rise, everyone is the only audience worth having. In one of Stankey's first acts upon taking control of the Time Warner portfolio, the company announced that the streaming world of HBO would now become HBO Max, adding a surname more associated with gallon-sized Slurpees than high-end TV productions. Then there was the original content. Most services try to have something that smells like a hit in the front of their lineup for launch time. Max lit the candle without anything bigger than an Anna Kendrick rom-com anthology. Warner's powers also failed to work out a deal to make the new service available on major OTT providers Amazon Fire TV and Roku. The phone company could not just give up, particularly not with an estimated $158 billion in debt. After signing on as Warner Media CEO in April, just before the launch, former Hulu CEO Jason Kilar had one obvious tool at hand, a whole studio full of movies. As fate would have it, thanks to the COVID pandemic, these movies were just sitting in a barn, waiting. Meanwhile, Nolan launched a very public nudge-nick campaign demanding the studio release his latest film, Tenet, on big screens in the middle of the pandemic. Eventually, the studio gave in, and Tenet bombed at a mostly closed box office, essentially ending talk of any studio releasing any major movie in American theaters in 2020. With that experience fresh and the new service floundering, Kilar made the movie that studio chiefs have dreamed of since the days of Betamax. Few believe Warner's insistence that they'll return to the theaters status quo ante. The window was smashed open, and there for other studios to step through. For years, the debate has raged as to whether this precise move would steal already dwindling audiences from the theaters or create a whole new one. Now we get to find out. All for the low price of burning your bridges to Hollywood's creative community, who vow Warner's will now be the studio of last resort. At the start of the new year, there were signs of detente. The standoffs with Roku and Amazon were settled, and so the service is now near universally available. Despite lukewarm to brutal buzz on Wonder Woman 1984, early analysis indicates it gave HBO Max a big bump in subscribers and interest. The negotiations will go on as Warner's tries to win back the trust of the Hollywood talent pool with some combination of massive checks and hand-holding. The directors, however, don't seem to be lining up just yet. Soon after the announcements, Wonder Woman series auteur Jenkins revealed that she is moving on to Disney to make a Star Wars film. She still signed on for fast-tracked Wonder Woman 3, which Warner Brothers swears will have a theatrical release. But even as the town moves on from the whole episode, a deeper fear remains that with this move, Warner Brothers has cracked the capstone. The collapse of film going is coming fast as companies race to retool for a brave new streaming age, perhaps leaving Hollywood's most romantic figure, the swashbuckling visionary director, behind for good. For the 27th annual Hollywood issue, Vanity Fair celebrates 10 creators and stars who showed us hope and humanity in a surreal year by Richard Lawson, with interviews by Anthony Bresnahan, Cassie DaCosta, Britt Hennemuth, and Katie Rich. Opening illustration shows Spike Lee flying on some sort of a hood ornament rocket above the New York City skyline. Anthony Bresnahan, Spike Lee, To Five Bloods, David Byrne's American Utopia. 100 years from now, historians are going to write that democracy as we know it almost came to the brink. Spike Lee has been truth-telling for decades, most recently with To Five Bloods, about black soldiers risking their lives for a country that sees them as disposable. And the Black Lives Matter movement has underscored the continuing relevance of his early films, like Do the Right Thing. Black people keep getting killed, he says. It's really a sad comment on the United States of America. Spike Lee can always be counted on to be succinct. It was an effed up year, 2020, he says. Just an effed up year, in bold letters with exclamation points. Effed up. Our last trip around the sun was a painful one, as political ills, both long-standing and recent, were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And now former president and his cronies looted what they could while leaving hundreds of thousands of Americans to die lonely, avoidable deaths. Dangerous conspiracy theories consumed the minds of thousands, if not millions, yanking attention away from very real problems, like police officers carrying out racist violence and domestic terrorism. It was a year of myriad stresses, of horror and loss, of confusion and despair. It wasn't enough to simply turn to movies and TV for mere escape, as we so often used to. Plenty of good old-fashioned escapism was available, of course, but there was also a hunger for more, for entertainment that transported while somehow addressing the darkness enveloping us. We looked for films and television series that illuminated, that said something crucial about what we were experiencing, that advocated for better, that championed goodness, that directed righteous condemnation at the people who had dragged us into what often felt like the worst possible scenario. Lucky for us, when seeking both comfort and the startling sting of awareness, we often found just that. Not always in the packaging we expected, but undeniably there. It was in The Casual Revolution of the Old Guard, a big action movie directed by a black woman, Gina Prince-Bythewood, that featured a central queer relationship. Charlize Theron was the star and co-producer of the film, solidifying her stature as one of the best purveyors of flinty, purposeful action heroism in the industry. It was in Sacha Baron Cohen's Borat sequel, which delivered a coup de grace against one of the most loathed and relentlessly corrupt figures in the Trump ecosystem, venal lawyer Rudy Giuliani. It's in 2021's Black Panther's true story drama, Judas and the Black Messiah, in which Lakeith Stanfield helps bring to vivid life a shameful chapter of recent history too often overlooked in America's consideration of its own past. In fact, everyone we've tapped for our 27th annual Hollywood issue worked to keep important conversations alive, either on screen or behind the scenes, or both. Maya Rudolph returned to her Saturday Night Live roots to gamely play the future vice president, as well as being a regular voice on the topical animated cult favorite Big Mouth, and producing Sarah Cooper's TV show with Natasha Lyonne, among others. Dan Levy's sleeper hit series Schitt's Creek offered much-needed humor while coaxing out plenty of happy tears, ending an updated Shakespearean comedy tradition with a gay wedding. Michaela Coyle, the bogglingly talented writer and star of I May Destroy You, managed to craft a narrative that addressed sexual violence, trauma, social media, art, race, and gender in just a short run of half-hour episodes. Lee gave a perhaps career-best role to industry stalwart Delroy Lindo in the furious Five Bloods, filmed the exhilarating Broadway show David Byrne's American Utopia, and made a short film about New York City reeling and grieving in the early siege days of the pandemic. Zendaya made history as the youngest winner of a lead actress Emmy for drama for her riveting series Euphoria, a bleak but compassionate look at Gen Z's sorrows, concerns, and culture. Not satisfied to rest on her laurels, she went and made a small movie during quarantine, the two-hander drama Malcolm and Marie. It has not been all triumph for the industry, of course. The twin wounds of halted production and the shuttering of movie theaters pushed Hollywood into an existential crisis, with many fretting that COVID-19 had finally killed the exhibitor business at which streaming services have long been chipping away. Though most of our Hollywood issue cover stars seem cautiously sanguine about the future of moviegoing, they are also more than willing to greet change as it comes, to get their work out into the world in as efficient and far-reaching a way as possible. Michael B. Jordan, who will further expand his career portfolio in the upcoming thriller Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, is learning to embrace adaptability, to consider all possible distribution channels as valid in their own way. Great material can live anywhere, he says. It's really about the audience and how they want to consume it, and that's not really for me to decide. Theron feels the same. Somehow it was meant to come out in 2020, she says, of The Old Guard, which hit Netflix last summer, and it was meant to just be on people's TVs. In the end, that's why I think it was so successful. It thematically speaks to things that people were going through. And so part of me is like, so what if it wasn't on a big screen? I'm not mad at the fact that probably more people saw The Old Guard than any other movie that I've ever made outside of Fast and Furious in a theater. Whatever the medium, the message for these creators remains clear. The mission of interpreting what's just happened to the world and what is still happening has become one of the main projects of their art. I think everything that we have gone through has only, from a creative standpoint, made the work that much more substantial, says Levy. Even if you're going to tell a little light comedy, it feels like it should be about something. The upheaval of the past many months and the undeniable wreckage that the new administration in Washington has begun addressing does present a chance for growth. It's an opportunity for people when you start to critically analyze those things, says Stanfield. Like, what kind of world do we want to live in? We can start recreating it now. Sometimes the hard battles are the things that are worth it. Baron Cohen is self-effacing about his work, calling it my little bit to fight for democracy, and adding, I am a comedian. I am an actor. I am not a political theorist. I am not a politician. I am not an academic. I would take whatever I say with a pinch of salt. However they view their own work, their audiences have been and will be invested. That ardency is shared mostly in the online realms we've been forced into of late. Sometimes, though, a rare in-person encounter is possible. I've had moments of getting slightly teary with a stranger on the street and sort of wishing you could hug, says Cole. But you can't hug. So we sort of just do this thing where we put our fingers where they almost touch. It's quite cute. That Cole could have such meet cutes over something as searing and sometimes grim as I May Destroy You may speak to exactly that deeper thing we've been hungry for. The world will continue to be vaccinated. Life will resume like some version of its old self. but we will not be able to shake what happened, nor will our struggle for better become miraculously easier with the changing of a presidency or two pricks of a needle. Nor should it. We hope these artists and more in the industry continue marrying amusement with meaning, telling us something new, or finally expressing something we've always known but never heard in such a bold and original way. The need for art's singular act of translation has maybe never been clearer. Its power to interpret the emerging and recurring patterns of civic life and make them legible. Emotion and thought are intangible things. Film and television help make them something close to manifest. Even if they're housed in quirky Canadian comedies or butt-kicking action movies about immortalish Avengers, there is still so much to be said and so much to be discovered in so many possible ways. The point is that it's said. That's my task as a writer, Cole says of her job, her calling, maybe, to look at this invisible thing and try to make it visible so that other people can see it. As ever, we'll be watching. From Brett Hinemuth, Zendaya, Euphoria, Malcolm and Marie. When the world stopped last year, says Zendaya, I had the urge to stay creative. The Euphoria star quarantined with the show's creator, Sam Levinson, and members of the newly furloughed crew, as well as actor John David Washington. Together, they created Malcolm and Marie, a raw two-hander about a couple having the argument of their lives. Zendaya, who made history as the youngest Emmy winner for lead actress in a drama series last September, even used her downtime productively. I tried to sharpen my video game playing skills. Cassie DeCosta writes on Charlize Theron, The Old Guard. Gina Prince Bythewood's fantasy flick, The Old Guard, sent a powerful signal that the right movie star in the right movie can still captivate audiences on a streamer like Netflix. Charlize Theron, who co-produced as well as playing a near-invincible mercenary, is nearly peerless in current-day Hollywood, so it's almost a relief to hear she's not cut out for homeschooling her kids. It's the first time in my life that I really had to confront how shitty and how terrible I am at something. Like, true failure, I'm a horrible teacher. Brett Hinemuth writes on Michael B. Jordan, Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. On screen, Michael B. Jordan has navigated Marvel movies, biopics, and indies. Off screen, he's lent his voice to Black Lives Matter, curated a charitable drive-in film series, and been producing inclusive movies and TV. Next up, Denzel Washington is directing him in Journal for Jordan about the death of a real-life Army sergeant who had been writing advice for his infant son. We first sat down after Fruitvale Station, says Jordan, but I wanted to have more life experiences so that I can actually breathe into this character. Katie Rich writes on Sacha Baron Cohen, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, Borat's subsequent movie film. He understood the power of humor and comedy to expose the ills of society and to humble the powerful. That's Sacha Baron Cohen talking about Abby Hoffman, but he could be talking about himself, too. With The Trial of the Chicago Seven and the Borat sequel, Cohen created spectacles. Hoffman on the witness stand, Borat in lingerie bursting in on Rudy Giuliani, that harnessed our anxieties for pointed humor. Baron Cohen calls his films My Little Bit to Fight for Democracy. Brett Hinemuth writes on Maya Rudolph, Saturday Night Live, Big Mouth. I'm now an elder, says Maya Rudolph, of her return to Saturday Night Live to play Vice President Kamala Harris. I'm now one of the elder women in the tribe, imparting wisdom. The actor, producer, and writer's homecoming has brought laughter and insight to a bonkers political landscape. I remember when Trump hosted for the first time for The Apprentice, and we as a cast were like, F, this sucks. I don't want to be here for this. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.